I'm Mary McCormick, and you're listening to Pod Clubhouse.
Pod Clubhouse.
I don't want to say things I shouldn't.
Because they're the truth?
Ted!
Willie, you had a life before me. I had a life before you. I understand that Bill's return has brought some emotions up to the surface.
I don't want to talk about it! I told you. I told you I didn't want to talk about it, and you had to go on talking. I told you. Fucking told you. Fuck.
This is Caroline.
And this is Mike. Welcome to the Duffy Wrestling Dirt Sheet of Heels podcast. Tonight we're talking about the penultimate episode of season one, episode seven, The Big Bad Fishman. It was written by Rodney Barnes, who I believe is the first episode writing credit for him on the show, and directed once again by our good friend who we've never met, Pete Siegel.
I feel like we need to be like, Pete, it's me.
We're going to have a 15-minute tutorial on how to say his name.
It shouldn't be so hard. Mike, what'd you feel about this one? Now, we have a different writer. Did you feel a different shift in pacing? Did you feel like anything, you know, could you tell that there was a different writer?
Can you tell? I think this episode explored different things that we haven't really explored. Obviously, we got a ton of Charlie Gully backstory and exposition.
The Big Bad Fish Man.
He's the Big Bad Fish Man. I think it's the first episode that doesn't have a wrestling term. Obviously, the Big Bad Fish Man refers to Charlie because he is a... I don't know what the counterpart is in Texas, but it would be like what we would call like Gander Mountain. Though I think Gander Mountain has actually gone out of business now. But for me growing up, it was Gander
Bass
Mountain.
Pro Shop.
There you go. Bass Pro Shop or not quite REI. An REI, but with like a fishing bent instead of a camping bent.
Definitely Bass Pro Shop then.
He is New York money come to the South to exploit the Georgians' love and Floridians' love of fishing and hunting.
He is uber wealthy, but you can definitely tell new money because he spends it in ways like a helicopter.
Yes, he is gaudy as fuck and flashy. Yeah, he is a spectacle. He is a spectacle everywhere he goes. Obviously, his suit. I think this episode was maybe the best example of his sartorial taste. And boy, he is flashy. You see Charlie Gully when he is coming, and you see him when he's going. But just the way he makes the entrance, when he lands the helicopter, which he does a flyby of his own property, full party, full in swing, just like an MTV spring break jam from like the late 90s kind of vibe about it. And he's not even there.
I was missing that vibe until those wrestlers like smashed stuff. And then I was like, oh, no, I don't miss that vibe. Yeah. I miss the fun party vibe, but boy, do I not miss like, you know, antics.
You got to love wrestlers who yell dystopia at their boss's pool party and do a drop elbow onto like the beer table, like the red Solo cup table. Weird. I mean, unnecessary. What did the drinks do to you, man?
So weird.
If that's a dystopia, I don't want to live in it. Yeah, so much Charlie Gully in here. I mean, it's complicated because there's things that he says that I agree with him 100%. And then there is stuff that comes out of his mouth about himself and just about the world and the way he thinks he acts and is in the world that just seems so out of left field. I don't know what story he's watching.
In a way, I feel like he gets to a good punchline, but his stories and the way that he explained things they're so like just windy and twisty and that you're like, whoa, I didn't see that coming. And the end advice it doesn't seem bad for the most part. I mean, even with his daughter, Lacey, right? Drinking in the Lambo and all that talk. Ultimately, you know, wait a little bit and then drive safely and all those. Like, I mean, it wasn't terrible advice, but it was so weird the way that, I mean, that whole interaction seemed like what is about to happen? Like she could like flash him or they could kiss or like something bizarre could happen.
The introducing of Lacey, the daughter, who I originally took to be underage, And she's still maybe. Originally, when she first appears in a doorway, I'm thinking she's 16, 17. As the scene went on, I got the impression maybe she's more like 19, 20, 21. So probably still underage, but just underage. Her interaction with Ace, it wasn't perverted. It wasn't like she's going to wind up in his bed. It was actually quite respectful. Like, my dad's a big fan of yours. We watch your videos all the time. It didn't feel set up either. Like, Charlie arranged for her to come in to stroke Ace's ego because it seemed like she legitimately was going in there because she wanted permission to take the Lamborghini out, the old Lambo.
Just the fact that she did that, you know, the fact that she came in to ask permission to her dad, like, there's, like, elements of, like, almost wholesomeness there, like, good values, but it's, like, packaged in this really tacky and, like, kind of, like, borderline, like, over-sexualized everything that makes you feel like something weird's going to happen. Oh, wait, she was totally mannerly and polite. But why am I getting this like vibe? Like something weird's going to happen.
Here's what makes him so interesting. And I think as the show has gone on, I have found myself more and more the same. I feel kind of about Wild Bill, more and more drawn to these characters because I think they're so goddamn interesting. Is I think he's just another example of the masks we wear. Right? The personas that we put forth for good business sake, right? Charlie Gully has to be the guy who wears the insane suits and hosts these rager parties, you know, has guys cutting each other up with barbed wire and just pandering to the basest, raw, you know, back of the brain Neanderthal man emotions of just blood and violence, right? He says to Ace at one point, this is not Shakespeare. Right? He really has the complete opposite view of wrestling that Jack has and that what Ace has kind of grown up with listening to his big brother. You know, for him, it's just, it doesn't matter what the fuck happens next week. Like, this week you beat the shit out of each other. Next week is next week. You know, you don't need stories. You don't, the people don't come for Shakespeare, right? They come for violence. They come to see grown men beat each other. And so everything seems to kind of feed that persona he wears, but then he can talk very eloquently about how the FWD is functional, unlike the DWL. He's got this interaction with his daughter where he gives cool dad advice because he's letting his daughter drive the Lambo after she's been drinking, but does have like a safety component to it, right? He takes like a measured moment. He obviously is weighing whether or not he trusts her, and he does. Like, there's this whole other side to him, this mature adult side, which is kind of part of his pitch to Ace. You know, we put on a spectacle in the ring, but we're professionals behind the scenes. I'm a professional. I may look like a performing buffoon. I may look like an out of control wild man. And maybe I am a little bit, and that's definitely a side of me, but I'm also professional. You know, I'm sober when I sign the checks. I know where all my money goes.
In my brain, I was considering him like a good time guy, and in the full sense of the word, that he can be a good time guy and also have common sense, like with the daughter. He can have, you know, some amount of business savvy. Also understand the value of a good time. Yeah. All of that together, when you mush it together, ends up with like this really funny character.
A really complicated character, I think. Well,
and a little unpredictable because it really feels like, I mean, when he doesn't skip a beat, admits to a priest molesting him, and without any change in his demeanor or his tone or anything, there's something about that. It's like you never know what he's going to say, but you can glean some good advice.
It's why I call my wrestling promotion a dystopia. It's a fallen world. He has a darkness-based worldview, but has a maturity and a savvy about him and a sophistication about him mixed in with the mania and the good times and the chaos and the debauchery and the bacchanalia of it all. But he also drinks light beer. So, you know, there's a lot. He's a mix of contradictions, right? He's who is it? Is it Walt Whitman that says, I am multitude, you know, I am large, I contain multitudes? That's Charlie Gully.
Yeah. I mean, I even go to the whole dome, you know, plastering it with the posters, this whole idea that it's a good prank and stuff. Even that, it felt so correct in that it was uneven. Like, it felt like, why would a guy with, you know, money and I mean, obviously he has goons and whatnot.
Sure.
Why would he personally go plaster this crap on the dome with full intention of taking it down? like in a couple days. Like the whole thing was like, that seems so juvenile for him. And like, also like the type of thing where he'd say, you could see him having the same conversation being like I have time in my day to fly to the dome and plaster it with pieces of paper. Like you could see him looking down on that and being like, that's so ridiculous. But then there he is. That's the unevenness of his personality. Like, it's just who he is.
He has a petty personal vendetta against Jack and the DWL and wants to see it fail and personally wants to be there to watch it burn to the ground and Jack fail. He doesn't hide that fact. It fuels him. It is, if you go to his origin story, you know, if he was like a super book, comic book villain, his villain story begins somewhere in the past with Tom Spade, King Tom Spade, and Jack and the DWL shunning him or spurning him. And it has to go beyond just the two podcast things where he slammed him because it is so personal, but he doesn't hide it. And so he's not going to just send his goons to go vandalize the dome. He's going to go there himself because he's got money to burn and he makes time in his day for things like going to vandalize the dome. Now, two interesting things about that. One is, when you see what him and his goons are going to do and they spend the better part of the night plastering the dome, I was expecting something super lewd or some kind of crazy FWD promotion or like pictures of, you know, a sucking Jack's dick, something really obscene. But it was just invites. It was cardstock, which again is a great detail that they hammer home. It's cardstock, really high-end cardstock invites to a party at Gully's mansion. The whole point of all of that was to goad Ace into driving down there because he is a master of psychology. And I think that's the takeaway from this episode about Charlie Gully. If he doesn't have a PhD in psychology and human manipulation, he at least has the School of Hard Knocks version of that. He knows it's going to elicit reaction from the Spade boys. He doesn't think Jack is going to deign to come down to Florida, but he's pretty sure Ace is. And that was his plan all along, right? Rooster is the bait. You're the fish. And it works.
Yeah.
And it works.
That made me so sad, actually. That exact moment, I felt so bad for Rooster.
So bad. When he comes in and
just
calls.
Being used and thrown away like that. Oh.
And juxtaposed against him having the best night of his life. I mean, he's in the ring covered in barbed wire, caused blood, and you know, holding the belt high and living his best life. All the while, literally, while that's going on the monitors, you have Gully saying, you're going to have the belt next week. He's just a bait. It's so sad. And then he comes in all cocky and he says, little bitch, to Ace. I just felt so sad. Rooster, you have no idea what's coming down the pipe, brother. Like, you don't get it. But that's Gully, though. He's master manipulator.
Yeah, master manipulator, but it made me feel so terrible because he actually acts like he does care. I mean, what part about
that
is
functional? Well, that's what makes him a master manipulator.
Yeah, but I'm saying, what part of what he did to Rooster makes the entire Florida dystopia functional? Do you know what I mean?
Well, sure, but it makes good business sense, though.
Man, like, I guess, I mean, it's all point of view. It's all, you know, where you're looking at it from. But man, for Rooster, ouch, this is exactly what Apocalypse was warning you about.
This is what Jack is warning this is what he's warning the wrestlers who remain behind when they're standing outside the dome in this clip right here. This is what he's warning against, this exact thing. What you don't get anywhere else except for at the DWL.
Back to the family. To the DWL, because fellas, you know and I know if you're standing here right now, it's not for the money, because I can't pay you any fucking money. I'd pay you if I could pay you. And I really do hope that one day I will be able to pay you for the money, but if you are here right now, it's because once a week, you get to get in that ring for a few minutes and you get to feel like a god. You get to walk into the Duffy Dome, and you don't have a job, and you don't have a boss, and you don't have a wife up your ass.
I would like a wife up my ass. Or anywhere near my body.
I'm looking for one, Diego.
Hurry, Bobby. Diego.
Look, here, the only person that you answer to is the crowd. We got the best crowd, fellas. And after the state fair, we're going to have the biggest. So, I say to Charlie Gully, is FWD cardstock the same thing that King Spade would say to Crawdad? Who gives a flying fuck?
Yeah. You have Jack, who the only thing he has to sell is the roar of the crowd and family. I can't pay you money, but I'll pay you in loyalty. And you have, You have Charlie Gully, who says he's selling loyalty, but all he's really selling is business. All he's selling is gladiators to the lions in the den in the Colosseum. That's all Rooster is. And honestly, after a while, when a fresh face came upon the Florida Wrestling Dystopia, or Jack Spade tapped out and was no longer a threat to him, Ace would also just become another victim to the Colosseum.
Absolutely.
You know, everything is disposable for Charlie Gully because it's good business for him. You know, him and his daughter are going to be okay. And I think at the end of the day, that's probably all he cares about. I mean, it's not admirable. It's good business. It's shitty ethics.
I don't know if it's good business. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but if anything that we care about when it comes to like Duffy and thinking about, you know, Apocalypse's whole thing about loyalty and being there and creating like this family and all this kind of stuff, I don't know if it's good business to keep bringing people in and using them like tissues. Like, it's all going to flush out in the end here. You know, someone's going to end up on top. Is it going to be being loyal and being family, or is it going to be a new guy every week? You know, we just use him and abuse him and throw him away.
I think at the end of the day, the thing that may end up hoisting Charlie Gully on his own petard is that personal vendetta. Because no matter how much it fuels you, or you feel like you're using it as an aid, and it's, you know, it's making, you know, the dark side is stronger than the light side of the force, and it's fueling, and hatred is good, hatred makes you strong, that kind of thing. There's a tipping point, though, where personal bullshit and vendettas go so far that you become blinded to what's actually important, whether it's what's important as from a business standpoint or what's important from a personal standpoint. When you give over to that anger, I think, and to the personal vendettas and the seething rage and hatred he has for Jack, which is so personal and so visceral, there's going to come a point where that's going to blind him into making some fatalistic mistake. I think that's what makes Charlie Gully kind of a classic villain at the end of the day, right? Mm. You know, evil has plenty in the trophy box, but good wins over evil in the end, to quote Ace from a couple episodes ago.
It's hard to believe that every one of those burned wrestlers wouldn't be seeking their own revenge. Like, I mean, if you're Rooster and the DWL is kind enough to take you back, man, I would think you'd want to like wrestle with a vengeance against the Florida people.
You know, it all depends, right? I mean, for right now, anyway, for this week, Rooster is getting everything that he was denied the DWL and every other indie circuit that he's wrestled in for 20 years. So for this moment, he can't possibly imagine a scenario where it's any better than what he's got right now.
I think that makes it worse. And it frightens me, frankly, that Charlie Gully wants to get women in this business with him.
He's a beacon of new hope for women in the business.
A real beacon.
There will be no bunny bombshells in the FWD. Women will be a new beacon. I mean, look at Mazzoni. I mean, she's a beacon of shining hope. When she rubs her nipples upon Ace's face to wake him in the morning, that is a beacon of new hope.
I mean, real beacon.
real beacon.
But the thing is that, like, I mean, if that's the way he treats his wrestlers, so forget about the fact that they're not, you know, bunnies. Okay, cool. But if you treat them all of them, men and women, like trash, you're not beacon for anybody.
I think you're 100% correct. And again, that's the flaw in the plan, right? Ultimately, it can't be sustainable business because eventually you're going to burn through every available wrestler. I mean, there are a lot of wrestlers out there in the world, a lot of amateur wrestlers, a lot of professional wrestlers, a lot of wrestlers on the indie circuit. But at some point, your reputation for being just a meat factory to chew you up and spit you out, and if you are around long enough, maybe to catch fire and go somewhere else, great. But most people just wind up on the garbage heap because they're replaced the next week. And you realize that you're the bait and someone else was the fish. Eventually, that's going to do you in. That's not sustainable in the long term. But in the short term, it's working for him, it seems. The question is, how much of his money is he throwing into the FWD too, right? That Gully Manor, that Gully Mansion, that helicopter, that store with the two-tier where he's got an office, an open-air office overlooking his kingdom at the fish store. How much money is this man sitting on? Even if the FWD folds tomorrow, I think he's probably going to be okay, which is
the
infuriating thing about villains, right? When when the comeuppance isn't sweet because you know they're going to land on their feet and be able to do some bullshit tomorrow.
You know, that mansion is so funny. It reminded me so much of the set that was used for Clueless. The staircase and where the different rooms were located. I was like, I know exactly what's going to happen when he walks through this room. This is going to be the kitchen. And when he walks through, like, I could already call it before he walked into the next room because the layout, I believe, is the Clueless mansion.
Very possibly. I mean, I think a house that with that kind of spread and that kind of land that gives you those kind of aerial views can only be so many sets, right? I mean, it's the kind of thing where some person rents that out a lot for TV productions. I gotta tell you, I loved his entrance, though. I mean, Gully is definitely a piece of shit, but I liked him kind of coming in and high-fiving people like he was coming down the ramp to a wrestling match, which is sad in its own right. Like, how many of these people, Gully, would be here if they weren't getting coke, booze, women or men, and money off of you? None of them would be here.
But he's paying them to party with him.
100%. 100%. But in the meantime, though, it looks cool when he comes in. He's like, high five and hey,
no, I'm Gully. It does look awesome. It does. Were you shocked to see that Ace, like, totally showed up there? Like, I mean, when he was, like, making this drive, were you like, guy's going to get in a car accident, something's going to happen? Or did you expect him to show up at Charlie Gully's?
I think all of Ace's actions in this episode were the most predictable things. They were the most Ace choice possible.
That's very true.
If it was like a choose your own adventure of normal person and the Ace choice, Ace picked the Ace choice every single time. From, of course, he's like, I'm gonna beat your ass, you mess with my family, have a beer with me, all right, I'll have a beer with you, you know. And then he's talking in, and that rule 34, were you familiar with rule 34? Have you ever heard that before?
So I wasn't. I mean, once he explained it, I was like, oh, like, I imagine that's very true. But no, I mean, is this that well known?
It is. Well, the rule is well known. I had never heard of it referred to as Rule 34, but I've heard of the maxim, which states that internet pornography exists concerning every conceivable topic. If it exists, there is internet porn of it. He was able to probably pretty quickly search, you know, Ace getting fucked by Jack and Ace kind of liking it. Totally rings true. I've heard the rule. I've never heard it called Rule 34, but it's definitely a thing. I looked into it. It is referred to as Rule 34. It has a whole history. You can go to the Wikipedia page to where the Rule 34 came from. The actual reference comes from a meme from years ago. But the maxim has taken hold and is known. Gully knows what buttons to push, at least on someone like Ace. He knows exactly what buttons to push because he says that there. He gives him the whole Rule 34. He shows him the picture. When he's talking to Crystal later, like the next day, the next night even, and Crystal's like, what about Jack? Because he's made his announcement that he's going to sign with the FWD. He goes, you know, fuck Jack, I'm tired of him bending me over. Rule 34 sunk right into Ace's brain, and it festered there.
Obviously, on, like, the main stage, you know, Ace showed everybody that humiliation was the key to him. I mean, he has done this twice now, you know, crying with Jack and then everything with Crystal and all that humiliation. And I just the whole thing. I mean, it's just time and time again. It's like, all you have to do is embarrass Ace and he'll do whatever you want.
From taking a beer to listening to everything Gully has to say and the fire going out of his belly immediately, waking up with a girl riding him and not throwing her off and getting out of bed, doing coke backstage before the show.
Did that surprise you?
No, none of this.
Like, straight to coke?
Yeah, I think he's probably done it before. I mean, we've seen him. He snorted the pills.
Yes,
you know,
that's true.
You know, and he had said to Bill when he initially refused it, he had said it as if he had tried it before because he says his stuff messes me up. So, okay. No, I don't think. He was a professional college athlete. I think most college athletes have probably done drugs at some point is my thing when they've had enough money thrown at them.
I guess it's just the whole, like, you know, all the concerns of Jack, you know, basically, like, unfolded in like 30 seconds, you know. And I don't know if that's just, like, so ridiculous or if that's like, no, that's totally Ace. Like, he was that close to the brink the entire time that, like, the second he's just, like, barely poked with a finger, he just falls completely over, you know. The women thing, I don't even think that registered for me because I'm like, yeah, but he he seriously fucks someone every episode.
He really does.
And they're different people, and it's no big thing, and he doesn't really care. And so the fact that this girl was there, and he didn't like, it was just like, whatever. This chick's just here, you know?
But it was, didn't know what time it was or where he was.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, but the girl being on top of him was the most normal thing about the situation for him. There's a point where you should take a long look in the mirror, you know, Ace, is all I'm saying, brother. You know, but at the same time, and you hit on something there about mentioning Jack, because I think when we get into talking about Jack, it's very important for us to talk about, does Jack in fact know what's best for Ace? Because Ace cannot take care of himself. Ace's decisions in this episode really shed light on that conversation, or at least make that conversation more complicated than what the obvious answer should be. And it's also relates to the flashback that opens this episode to that Rockin' REO Speedwagon song and the conversation with Papa Spade, you know, about what's good for Ace. Ace is on you know, a fast train to hell, and I know what's best for him, and I need to keep him close to keep him alive. No one wants to hear that, but Jack is resolute in his belief that he knows what's best for Ace. I was curious if you compared all of that Ace nonsense and those bad choices to watching his face crumble a little bit when Gully reveals his true colors, that Rooster isn't going to hold the belt beyond a week, that he is the bait to Ace's being the fish. Was there some regret on Ace's face there? Did we see? Was there some trepidation where what he's gotten himself into all of a sudden?
I think so. I think because, you know, a couple of reasons. One, he knows that Rooster is his friend. You know, at the end of the day, he cared about him. And I'm not saying that they're like good pals, but I am saying like he didn't want to see him get crushed necessarily. And he knows this is going to crush him. And I think also when he just sets up that again, sort of going back to those, like, what are like the unspoken rules of wrestling, even in these like kind of smaller leagues, when he says, well, shouldn't he hold the belt a little longer? Shouldn't we build it up? Like, he, you know, he's trying to follow these like rules, if you will. And so when Charlie Gully's just like, brr, like, that's not even a thing. I think there was like a moment of like, oh shit. Like, I thought I knew the game we were playing, and I even thought I knew the rules, and turns out I don't know anything. And I'm going to like actually watch my friend get crushed here.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I think what we're seeing here plays out actually in professional wrestling. There is this whole extreme rules wrestling, this whole hardcore wrestling segment of the population out there that wants to see the Charlie Gully product, that doesn't care about story, doesn't care about building it up, doesn't care about good versus evil and that soap opera fiction playing out in the ring and the storylines. You know, I've called it a couple times in this series, like, it's soap opera for men. That's what modern wrestling is, especially WWE sports entertainment. You know, that's what it is. It's plots, it's storylines, it gets you invested, it keeps you in your seats, you want to know what happens next because you become invested in these people's lives. That's one side of it, and that is predominantly what modern wrestling is. This Charlie Gully product still exists today in hardcore matches, backyard matches, you know, it's seedy underground parking lots with bad lighting, you know, where whips and chains and barbed wire and lots of blooding and cutting to make yourself bleed on your forehead, all of that still goes on. And there's a whole population that does want to see that. I just want to see men beat each other or women beat each other and bleed and get in pain. And then the strongest one wins. So it's an interesting dynamic that the show has set up, this good versus evil concept of wrestling itself, you know, storylines and, you know, wrestling Shakespeare versus this Charlie Gully product of just this week is all that matters and maximum violence is our goal.
Well, and I'm going to go back to, you know, a lot of the things that I feel like Jack has been preaching, whether it's like faith or whatever, there's always been this sense of integrity. And I think that moment of standing there and Rooster coming and it all being a ruse just to get Ace there, and then Charlie is like, yeah, no, he's not gonna hold the belt, and we're just all like this whole game, to realize that Charlie doesn't have integrity, that he isn't going to give the respect to the sport the way that even as periphery as Ace really is to the rule following, there was still some stability in that. And to just see that all thrown away, I mean, I think his face said everything.
Very sad. Very sad. But I think we should get into Jack. And I want to go to the opening flashback. One thing, I mean, we have to pay tribute to it. Roll With the Changes is a great song. REO Speedwagon is a great song. Is a great band. It's the only thing I think I've agreed with Papa Spade this entire season. They are fantastic. So let's just say that right up front. And when you hear Roll With the Changes cue up on the soundtrack, you know you're in for a good episode. That's what I'm saying. It's like a Wild Night is preordained, is going to be good times from here on out, or at least interesting times. What did you think? We talk a little bit about this in our upcoming interview with Allison Luff. But what did you think about Jack's comment that he didn't want to speed because Stacy was saving for a vacation? How did that hit you versus the Jack we've seen all season long?
Well, I think it was finally feeling like we were getting that little glimpse that we've been hungry for to understand what their relationship was like before. Also, a really good moment to understand that Dad is a horrible example of a husband, you know, and like just sort of blowing Stacy off and acting like what she would want doesn't matter. I mean, speaks volumes about him and Carol. But yeah, I felt like, wow, okay, so Jack would have been disrespectful to just a project she's doing. He's not going to purposely wreck what she's trying to do. That was a happy thing. That was a moment I was like, oh, good, okay, all right. So this marriage was like that. But I think we kind of had gleaned that.
Right.
We pretty much knew that all this outrage was coming from a place of change.
Yeah, I think I was happy for the line more because we had been asking, show us a version of Jack that's not this man, so that it makes it clear to us our inkling that he is just radically different now than he was before his father's death. That the intervening year since his father's death has changed him. And maybe not in a great way, and has changed his behavior, and not only in his overall relationship with Stacy, but just respect paid to her. This episode, last episode, we've seen time and time again, you know, voila, fucking gerbil, like just chime and time again, like modern, this Jack of the present day heels would not worry about Stacy saving money for a vacation. He would say, I need it for a fog machine, you know.
Go a step further. The flashback has him saying, I don't want to speed because I don't want a ticket to ruin Stacy's like vacation plans. And in the present day, he's saying, this is a place where your wife's not up your ass. That's what he thinks of having a wife now.
Right.
So, right. I mean, boof, that's huge.
Yeah, and exactly. And I think what this scene shows is that in the intervening year since Jack has had to take over for King Tom Spade, he has slowly, like some kind of horror movie, has slowly morphed into King Tom Spade. Here, in just a very short scene, this is only a 3-4 minute scene, this entire scene of them driving and then taking a pee on the side of the road. Here are some quotes from Tom Spade. No son of mine is too good for pissing on the side of the road. I'll drive. I'm not afraid of my wife. You're just like me. You're always operating. And then, of course, as real men settle it violently, if you pin me, you can have it and you can run the DWL any way you want.
All of that seemed like a horrible setup. And I have no idea. I mean, you're a son. I have no idea how you get out of something like that. What do you do? If your father's looking at you or you're a dad, if you were to pull some crap like that, you have to fight, right? Like, there's no way to get out of that situation. Can you just walk away and be like, I'm not doing this?
No. No, I mean, yes, can you? If Jack turns his back on Tom Spade takes some kind of stick and hits his son. Because I think he would see that along the lines of, you're too good to take a piss on the side of the road. Like, this idea that you're too good to fight me. Like, we fight, boy. You know, that whole idea. I mean, it's in my notes. For me, this is the episode theme, right? I want to play these two clips and show how close the apple has landed from the tree.
You don't come for my shit, boy. Don't come for my shit, boy.
Two generations of men who have boiled their entire lives down to, you don't come from my shit, boy. That's like caveman talk. That is Neanderthal caveman talk. Of it's what Stacy is railing against in the kitchen when Thomas gets sent home for bullying. Yes, we don't settle shit by fighting. What we've lost the thread, you know, she says.
Yes. So I didn't grow up in a family like that. What's yours is mine and mine is yours is how my family works. And so this idea of like, you don't come for my shit. It's so not familiar to me. That alone, the way that Jack was obviously wanting to work with his dad and wanting to make this a family business. And then, like you said, watching how he's now going to say, don't come for my shit. Now we can see why he can't function as a family business. Like, he has no roadmap for how to include other people and not act like they're coming for him. You know, it's like share for everyone, like family style. There's a reason why it's called family style, right? Like, think of the joke of that. Right. Family style is when everyone shares out of the same bowl. So by definition, when you say, you know, I'm having this business, it's your family business, then everybody is a part of it, you know? There is no, you don't come for my shit.
Remember, though, they grew up in a household where the green bean casserole only serves two. So this is not a family that has ever believed in family style, it does not seem.
Obviously.
You know, it's interesting. I don't understand this point of view. You know, so much of my life as a dad is about wanting to build things for, like, Tom and for the generation to come. One of the things that you and I and Paul talked about when we started PCH was we wanted to build something that our kids could be involved with down the road. They're all pop culture nerds and they're into the same things that we're talking about. They're little versions of us, or in Jack's case, a big version of you. When Jack is talking to his father so passionately on the side of the road because he's revealed that he's already hit up Eddie Earle about the dome needing fixing and that there's going to be money and he wants to make changes, and he's already shown here he's got big plans for growing the DWL and they involve Ace. Like, that's all here while Tom is still alive, that he's revealing the seeds of those plans, right? He's planting seeds, right? That's one of the things Tom Spade seizes on in this scene. I'm embarrassed for Jack. It made me cringe hearing him talk so lovingly about this family business, because Tom Spade looks on it with such disdain, right? There's anger in this man's heart listening to his oldest son talk about building a family business that's gonna thrive.
He has a bizarre relationship with Jack. His relationship with Ace is so very different. He has like a real like King Prince kind of situation, like where it's like, you know, don't come from my throne kind of business all the time. It's like where he's just constantly beating Jack down and lifting Ace up. It's so odd, you know?
Tom treats Jack, and he says here, like, you're always operating, you're just like me. He makes these comparisons to him and his sons a couple of times in these flashbacks, but Jack is always the negative connotation, right? He's always like Jack in a negative way, according to Tom Spade, whereas Ace is like Tom in a good way, you know, potential and flair, not cockiness. That's Ace. That's Tom Spade sees himself in Ace in that way. But you're manipulative. You're planting seeds. You're talking at a turn. You know, you're not anything better than being a grunt wrestler in this business that's not going to grow. It's almost like he's determined for it not to be a thing.
Or not to be Jack's thing. It can be Tom's thing and grow, but it can't be Jack's thing and grow.
Jack is not allowed. Not only does it seem Tom doesn't think Jack is capable of doing anything great in his life, it is almost like Tom affirmatively and aggressively wants to prevent Jack from doing anything with his life.
While simultaneously, you know, raising Ace up on this platform and wanting him to be able to do everything.
Well, he says he's got a different destiny and path than we do. These brothers are not that far in age.
Right.
What? Why?
I hope we get some backstory on, like, what in the world? Why are they treated so differently?
I mean, if this was like a Shakespearean tragedy, it would have been because, like, Jack's birth caused the death of his mother or something, right? That, you know, some pre-existing condition of hatred and resentment towards Jack is how Tom Spade acts.
Right. Or he was like Carol's from a previous marriage or some business, like some sort of like somehow Tom doesn't have to treat him like a full son.
Right. Well, maybe he's wearing some horns. Maybe he got cucked and he's maybe, you know, I mean,
I don't know anything. Jack, they look very different.
Jack and Ace don't look a lot alike.
Yeah, I would say Ace doesn't look a lot like Tom at all. Just saying.
Yeah, so a really revelatory flashback, and not to be spoilery, but this flashback I think is really important for who Jack is and who Jack was, and that relationship with Tom. There's a flashback that opens up the season finale that is a part of this flashback in a way. I mean, it's a different flashback, but it feels very much a part of this. It mirrors it
for sure.
These two things together kind of fill in a jigsaw puzzle in a big way about Jack, Ace, and Tom and that interrelationship.
It does in terms of like what their relationship is, but not the why of it. And that's what I'm so curious about. Like, yeah. I want to know why this is the relationship.
Can we talk about the next generation of Spade men? Can we talk about Little Thomas? Little Thomas, played by the wonderful Roxton Garcia.
Poor Little Thomas. He had quite a go in this episode. I was really surprised to see his behavior at school. I didn't see that coming at all, to be honest with you. His whole behavior after that, first of all, I have to laugh because I know that you have preached to me that a good way to get out of any situation is to say you have to go take a dump, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Look at Thomas using this skill set to get out of this conversation with his parents.
I mean, mine was used in a peer pressure situation. If someone is ever trying to make you do something that you don't want to do, just say you have to go take a dump because no one really wants to continue that conversation. But yeah, he uses it effectively here to really interrupt.
As soon as he did, I was like, damn, I've seen it in motion.
And the conversation's over. There is no further talk. Like, his shit interrupts this entire conversation, and God bless him for it. The way they're focusing in on that big wooden hall pass as he's walking towards the water fountain, I thought for sure we were about to get some kind of Stephen King level wood whipping. They were so focused on I felt a confrontation coming. It just felt like that. And when that little boy says, "Get fucked, third grader," I grasped my pearls. I'm doing it right now. I'm holding my pearls around my neck.
I'm clutching
them. Just even hearing that echo in my head of a little kid saying, "Get fucked, third grader."
I was taken aback because, yeah, that's not a line you hear every day. I mean, voila, you know, fucking gerbil. There's that. But get fucked, third grader.
Yeah, Stacy didn't tell a kid get fucked, third grader. She didn't say that to Thomas. But when he the way they were zoomed in on that thing, I thought for sure he was about to start nunchucking the shit out of those kids with that wood pass. But no, he just threw a good old classic American punch to the face. Didn't see that coming. I didn't see this storyline, especially after Thomas gives that great pitch to the fair committee about how wrestling is a story and using his uncle and his father as preeminent examples of how the wrestling story plays out and the reason people come back week after week for it. I didn't see this plot line coming at all. This idea that he no longer understands or the lines have become so muddied for him about what's real and what's fake. And Stacy, I think, really clarifies it best when she talks about how the grown men of the DWL are acting like wrestling is real.
That's the part that I think is huge. And I mean, I know that they did do a building with this. Obviously, you know, we saw Thomas witnessing the entire thing between Ace and Jack at the hospital. There were parts here that we knew that this was coming. I just didn't see him acting out like this.
Yeah.
I thought it would affect his relationship with Ace and Jack. I didn't see him becoming, you know, this kid who's going to lash out.
Yeah, well, actually, listen to the clip in case people didn't remember, because I think it's one of those key lines in the episode.
You got suspended for a week.
You can't hit people out of anger.
Daddy and Uncle Ace at the hospital.
Uncle Ace broke Bobby's leg.
That's no excuse for Daddy.
Uncle Ace deserved it. He is bad.
No, he's not bad. He's just...
He's bad and he cries and people throw Kleenex at him and hate him.
That's all pretend.
No, if it was pretend, people wouldn't be sad and mad hurting each other. It's okay to hurt someone so they'll know you're mad because of what they did.
If that is truly what you think, then we have failed you as parents.
Hey, mister, get back here.
I've got to go, number two.
Hurry up.
You hit Ace at the hospital?
Ace broke Bobby's leg and I had to get through to him.
Well, now your son's getting through the same way.
No, he's going after bullies at school. Poor year older.
Right, so you think this is cool?
I got in plenty of fights when I was a kid.
Because you needed attention.
Because I went to school with assholes.
We're not raising our son to beat people up. We have lost the thread here, Jack.
When Thomas says that line that it's okay to hit people to let them know that you've made them mad and sad, that's chilling. That is chilling for a kid. I mean, and again, Alison Love does a great job. She mentions how kids are sponges and how we all forget from time to time the things we say and do around kids because they do see and they do pay attention. But that is a chilling line hearing come from a kid as his formed worldview because of what the adults in his life do.
I think it was incredibly sad. And I think that the entire change in Thomas is so big in this episode. I mean, we spend so much more time with him and Stacy than almost any other episode, I believe. It's just so much. You know, it really hurt my heart. The entire conversation in the car. We talk about all this with Allison for next week, but it hurt my heart. And I felt like what a toll. We had talked about this taking on their marriage, but man, now to see this toll taking on the kid, wow, it was really harsh.
I mean, it's in my handwritten notes from the episode, but I have no written over again. When he's talking in the car about his spirit being broken, you know, again, parroting that line from his uncle a couple episodes ago, you know, my spirit is broken like granddad Ace's. And so this idea of, do we have to worry about Thomas doing self-harm in some way? When you know that his spirit is broken is code for why the grandfather killed himself. How do you not go to that? Now, he's a little kid. He's 8 years old. And so 8 years old doesn't maybe translate one for one. Spirit broken doesn't necessarily mean suicide. But as a parent who has watched this series, I'm freaking out that we have to put him on this watch that he's going to cut himself, or he's going to self-harm, or he's going to start hurting other people.
I don't think it's a leap for an eight-year-old. I mean, that was the explanation he was given for why granddad did it. And so for him to use the same words. Now, here's the interesting thing. Stacy doesn't know that those were the words that were used. And so she doesn't necessarily know the significance, but I don't think that it would be outside the realm of possibility that Thomas understands what he said.
There's so much that Stacy doesn't know that goes on in her life.
I know.
And this conversation, obviously, you know, she's not privy to, especially an Ace-Thomas conversation. It's not like Thomas went and maybe he did, but we didn't see it. So we have to assume that she doesn't know what this is all code word for. I think she does a great job of addressing and saying, you know, we all get sad sometimes. And you know what? It gets better and we'll fix this together kind of thing. And he seems happy, right? He smiles. You know, she says she asks him to help him out in the store, which kids love that kind of thing, being involved and helping. And so for at least right now, there's a Band-Aid on it. But yeah, she doesn't. I think she has a different reaction if she knows the context in which he's using spirit is broken. I certainly knew it and I was freaking out. I mean, I have to imagine a season two plot line. I don't know that this gets resolved in next week's episode because it seems like it's okay now. But as season two rolls around, I think you got to put a post-it note on Thomas and his very difficult feelings, complex feelings.
I absolutely agree with you. And how he can be a part of this world and understand it and understand where the line is when the grown men don't understand where the line is. Their lives are fully run by the DWL. I mean, fully. Every second, you know, if someone comes over to their house, it's only been about the wrestling league, you know, like including they literally don't have other things going on. Yeah.
Even Stacy finally gets to interact with another female on the show, and both interactions, both times she's there, Crystal shows up. It's about the DWL. She does have a moment, though, where maybe there's a track of her life coming outside of the DWL. You know, I want to bring it up here just because we made a post-it note for it. Eddie Earle coming through right away, talking to Nikki Holloway about the Georgia State Rodeo Championship. What did you think of this? Stacy's finally going to go get out from the DWL shadow, you know, and go do something on her own.
I'm excited for her to have her own storyline and have something that she's interested in and can pursue that is a little bit less. I was reminding myself the other day as a podcaster, I should 100% know the term for this, but I'm blanking right this second. I did have my COVID booster shot today, so I'm going to blame that for a second. I'm a little extra tired. Women should be able to exist outside of their connections with men, right? You know that whole thing, good writing.
The Bechdel test?
Mm-hmm. And when I look at Crystal and I look at Stacey and I look at even Willie, for that matter, I really am not seeing women that exist outside of whatever their relationship is with men. And for Crystal, it's changed which man. It's sometimes it's Jack, sometimes it's Ace, sometimes it's Bill. You know, it changes, but it's still the same problematic situation. Where does she exist outside of these men?
Well, and it's interesting because they're all trying or not trying to varying degrees. Like, Willie's not really trying. I think she's a little defeated at this point and is not actively trying to get out from underneath the men of her life. And, you know, there's that very kind of powerful scene with Ted in the episode. But Crystal is. I mean, Crystal makes a decision because she's got no avenues left. She grovels in a scene that made me so sad for her because of the stony silence with which Jack greets her.
What did you think that? Like, when he had zero response, he's like, thank you for saying that. And, like, that was it?
Yeah.
Were you shocked?
I mean, Jack's treatment of Crystal, I really thought it was, after the first couple episodes, I thought it was going to be on this upward trajectory where he increasingly treated her and saw her as the asset she is. But it's U-turned and has actually just gotten worse and worse. And his treatment of her, it's this conversation with Willie. I mean, I could play this here because it speaks to everything that is wrong with how Jack treats Crystal and why.
I know she's small, but she is acrobatic as hell. And what she's really got is just it. You just want to watch her.
I don't want to watch ballet.
But she can be more than that.
Sure, yeah. She could go off script and have Bobby Penn's leg snapped in two. Do you forget?
I remember it well. I remember it was Ace who did the actual snapping.
Oh, okay. So you got to make a choice right now between Crystal and Ace, and you're saying that you choose Crystal, because that's the choice. They cannot be together anymore, Willie. It's not safe.
Fans like her just as much as Ace.
Bullshit! You want to put her in the main event with me, Ace, and Bill?
I do.
She's 5 foot nothing.
5'3". Who gives a fuck? It's fake.
Well, she can't pick me up. Can she pick up Ace? Can she pick up Bill?
She didn't have to pick anyone up. Oh, you think Bob Backlund could have really beat up Jimmy Snuka? You write the scripts. Have him lean in like Andre did for Hulk, for fuck's sake. Come on, and write for the times. I mean, why do you think the Real Housewives are so popular, huh? Women can be terrible to other women. So let's give them the opportunity to be terrible to each other in the DWL ring.
It's not about what she is, it's about who she is. And who she is the girl who did a number on my little brother.
It's not about what she is, it's about who she is. And who she is the girl who did a number on my brother. You are running a goddamn business for one thing. What does her Ace's fucking feelings have anything to do with whether or not you have a fair and you have no fucking wrestlers? You have your business manager, your most trusted ally, the only person you remotely listen to, telling you this girl could be the future. And he won't hear it because why? Ace is so insecure. Ace is so fragile. Ace has fucked everything that moves in Duffy. Jesus.
Not only that, but he's also over in Florida. Like,
right.
the complete confusion of like who to be loyal to and where, you know, your actual supporters lie. Oh,
do you know who the only main roster wrestler that wasn't at the tryouts, either working or watching? Ace! Where was Ace? He's the only one who's not there. They only needed Debbie's there holding shit down, giving out the flyers. They didn't need Apocalypse there or Bobby there. Bobby can't do anything. His leg's broken. They didn't need Diego there. They're all there watching. They're invested. Where's Ace? He leaves. He's at the Dome. And he leaves after the conversation about, you know, who's Jack going to give the belt to. And he goes to Florida. Crystal is there. Crystal has shown up at your house groveling on her knees. She's writing letters. How many people do you think in Duffy, Georgia resign their positions with a typed letter? Probably not a lot. Probably not a lot. That is a classy ass move of her. And then she's there busting her ass trying to get out from underneath these men.
This storyline of blaming her for Bobby and Ace, it's gone too long. And I know I said this an episode or two ago where I was like, Mike, this is going on too long. Like, no nobody is relenting that Crystal is the problem.
Well, Willie does here, though. What did you think of that, though? Because that's movement.
But finally, right. I mean, finally. But that, but it was such a small little volume tick, you know, that I was like, mm-hmm. holy cow, how long are we going to go with this? Crystal is the problem in this entire mix, you know?
I, you know, it's interesting that scene between Jack and Willie, because Willie finally brings it up. She's the first person to say, I remember very clearly it was actually, you know, Ace who did the breaking, not Crystal. And Jack doesn't even dispute it. Jack's response to her is, okay, fine, granted, but then you have to make a choice, one or the other, because they can't be together because it's too safe. It's not safe. Why isn't it safe? Because Crystal didn't break anyone's legs. Ace broke someone's leg. He's the problem. And also, he's in Florida.
And Willie is not even proposing that they be anywhere near each other. She said, right. let women be terrible to other women. That's what she said.
Right.
So it's like Jack can't even hear any ideas, a la his father, right. without freaking out. Because Ace doesn't need to be anywhere near Crystal. Crystal could come out with other female wrestlers and have nothing to do with him. And it's insane. They live in a teeny tiny town. This concept of like they just all need to be kept separated is like, come on, dude. Right. I mean,
right. Debbie plants the seed again, planting seeds. You know, why don't we have women wrestlers? That Willie is what goes to Jack about. Right. She's not saying put them. I mean, she is saying put them in the main event, put her in the main event with Ace, Bill and Jack. But overall, she's making a pitch for we should have a divas section, a women's wrestling division here at the DWL. It's where modern wrestling has gone. Every promotion, every major promotion has women wrestlers. It's so backwards. It's so Tom Spade of Jack in this scene.
And just so antiquated.
Well, like, that's what I mean by Tom Spade. It's so last, like two generations ago. Yeah, it's really troubling. And yeah, his whole attitude towards her is a big turnoff towards me. It's such a dark aspect of his character.
I'm really enjoying the fact, though, that Willie, for those who are really diehard wrestler fans, points out, you know, like, well, what about, you know, these wrestlers, and like showing how there's like this happens all the time where people are like there's an imbalance in weight or size or whatever. And there's still 100% ways to have them wrestle one another. Right. So I'm glad that she said that, because in an episode that wasn't really about wrestling, it was important that an average watcher who maybe doesn't see wrestling on the regs doesn't just sit back and say, well, Jack's right. You know, how is she going to lift like a 6 foot plus man who's much bigger than her? And it was important to inject that little bit of like, no, this is acrobatics. This is, you can lean on each other. You can like make it work together. Choreography, basically. Right. And, you know, I think that that moment, it didn't get a hard enough beat with Jack that I felt like it should have, because it really showed that Willie knows her stuff.
Right.
You know, again, it gave her like credibility that like, I don't just like show up here and get a paycheck. Like, I know how things are done. Do you, Jack?
Right. And she's calling back to the golden age of wrestling too. I mean, Hogan versus Andre the Giant in particular was a real David versus Goliath thing. Cause Hulk Hogan is, you know, Hulk Hogan, you know, his 24-inch python arms and stuff like that. But Andre the Giant was like the eighth wonder of the world. Yeah. When they met in WrestleMania and Hogan, you know, body slams and picks him up and body slams him and wins, you know, I think it's WrestleMania 3 or 2 or 3, you know, that was the world shifted. This idea that he could be beaten, he was this colossus, and Hulk Hogan persevered, this face persevered over this heel, you know. And the funny thing is Andre the Giant and Hulk Hogan were like great friends behind the scenes. When Andre the Giant passed, Hogan gave some like beautiful eulogies and told some great stories about them behind the scenes. But in the ring, it was right. It was choreographed moves, you know, and not for anything, Jack. No, I don't want to watch a ballet. Motherfucker.
That was incredibly dismissive.
It's
incredibly
reductive and dismissive. You have all of your wrestlers, you know, jumping off the top rope, except for the one who can't, who you put in a match with the unhinged violent man. Right. All of them. Rooster's entire thing is he's a high-flying wrestler. And by the way, you've seen Crystal at least once at this point do a really common but effective wrestling move with that Rana, that scissor, leg scissor takedown that she does. She does it outside the bar.
How can he ignore that? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like,
because his brother got hurt.
But like, when Willie is pointing out to him and he calls it a ballet, when, again, like, you almost have to ignore the fact that they had been in a bar fight where she completely pulled this amazing move, not choreographed, not in a fake scenario, and was effective. How are you calling her effectively a ballerina? Like, what?
Right. And also, you weren't there at the tryouts. Like, you weren't trusting Willie to run your tryouts.
That is beyond confusing, Mike. Are you not at tryouts if you are the owner of the entire thing?
I mean, the Spade brothers are the only ones not at the tryouts, which is baffling. But your most trusted lieutenant, who you have put in charge of the tryouts because you're not going to be there yourself, you know, takes down Wild Bill in his pigtails, which are hysterical.
They are adorable. When he called them Pippi Longstocking, I was
when she like locks up with him the second time and shows that she's actually going to give it a fight, he flicks his pigtails one at a time with his finger over. It's hysterical. Chris Bauer is owning that role in such a great way. I love it so much. But she takes him to the mat. You know, I mean, she does what Jack wasn't able to do with his father in the opening flashback. She pinned him. She put him on the mat. She should own the fucking DWL. Jesus Christ. You're gonna take the dad over Crystal? Get the fuck out of here. That's insane to me. But he's not even there to watch. So who knows?
He's not taking anyone. He's just not taking Crystal.
Did you notice the little remark that he made? Because you and I have pointed this out all season long about what's in Willie's cup, and we finally got confirmation in the last week's episode that it's booze in her cup. Mm-hmm. He says, "How much Maker's Mark did you put in your cup this morning?" when she first begins the opening salvo of Crystal Tyler's Not That Bad. He says, "How much Maker's Mark did you put in your cup today?" I thought that was a pretty cheap shot, low blow to Willie.
And so far, he had been pretty respectful towards Willie. He's getting really ugly. When you're saying the transformation into King Tom, I mean, I'm seeing it.
Dickie Valentino brings up last week, right? The Mick Foley special guest star role, the podcast. He says, "You've got some of your dad's anger in you, don't you?" We don't see it all the time, but when Jack is pissed or Jack is annoyed, there's no buildup to Jack's temper. He goes right for the fucking jugular and brings a stiletto knife and slides it in. It's vicious.
It's everything that we hated about Ace and like this, the comments to Helen and all the things that, you know, he's described his dad as acting like. I mean,
it's everything we hate about Tom. It's everything that we've seen about Tom that we don't like. That's what I'm saying. In this year, that's why that line about Stacy and the vacation and the speeding ticket is so important to me in this episode, because everything else about Jack in the present time goes against that guy. Almost everything. I don't want to paint him point blank, because I think at the end of the day, I think a lot of what he's doing is because of his concern for his brother. I know we're dunking on him a lot with everything, but I don't want to lose sight of that, though, because I think he genuinely does care about keeping Ace alive. And I think he is genuinely worried about how long that will be if he doesn't keep a micromanage over his life. To that end, I wanted to ask you, is it fair of Stacy to downplay the emergency nature with which Jack is treating the fact that he now knows Ace is in Jacksonville and is about to go get up on stage with Charlie Gulley at an FWD show and sign with him, deep dick, if you will, the DWL. I gotta tell you, I found it a little dismissive of Stacy to not take that actually as a pretty big emergency, given what she knows about the state of things. I was curious about your position on it.
I think that we're giving too much credit about what she seems to understand about the state of the union here. Because, I mean, here's the deal. I have been confused the whole time how much Stacy has been kept isolated away from the DWL. I mean, she seems to have met Crystal like once. I mean, she even says like, "I don't know you, Crystal." Hello, Crystal has been with Ace for how long? They've been at all these shows. Like, she doesn't seem to be like the wife who ever goes backstage or something. So
no.
There's some element that I have to say, well, they've never given us an indicator that she does know how the DWL works, or that she does know the individual people, or that she even really gets the Charlie Gully stuff. So in that case, as much as I find it like absolutely insane, because I certainly would know all these inner workings, they've been consistent that she doesn't get it and that she doesn't. She's in, and we can say, I'll even say it more kind than that. She has never been let in on any of these things. She's not allowed to participate. So in that way, I don't think she has any idea how big this really is, even though that's really hard to wrap my brain around.
She does know about the tissues, though. I'll tell you what. She goes down to the Piggly Wiggly and she gets to the bottom of the tissue thing. Man, did you see that coming? Did you see that coming as a reveal? I never thought that the tissues were going to come back in such an important way, nor that that would be the hill upon which she dies. Like the thing that finally breaks the back that makes her leave the house. I mean, I get it and I see thematically, and actually I think the show has done a good job of building it, that it's the kind of thing, it's just one step too far. But also, I never pictured the tissues again, which to me seems like a pretty defensible.
Yeah, that's what I mean about not understanding how it works.
But Jack never told her, though.
Yeah, no, I 1,000%. That's the thing. That's the whole like danger of this whole thing. Like he's trying to keep her out of it for whatever reason. I don't even know that's ever really been addressed. But at the same time, it's like by doing that, he can continuously yell like she just doesn't get it. She just doesn't understand. She doesn't understand the podcast. She doesn't understand why we have to do these different things. Well, she's a smart lady who's proven she can do a lot of things. Why don't you just explain it to her, you know, or let her in so that she knows what's going on? I mean, of course, and we talk about this with Allison, you know, the whole, there were so many opportunities to tell more clearly what role Jack played with Ace's humiliation. I understand it's like this small thing, but it's this tangible thing, this tissue thing. It really represents the orchestration of taking Ace down and how much planning went into it. I think that part is the like, you know, blinking neon light of like, you better get out of here because this guy is not the guy you thought he was. And I think that's what would send me to the car packing.
You know, there are a couple of good Jack moments in this episode, and I think they're worth mentioning. He starts off the meeting with Wild Bill and Ace and Willie and talking about how the fact that normally he would just write the script and not involve any of them, but you know, he wants to do this differently. He wants to hold a creative meeting. Is that growth? Should we be giving Jack some props here for showing for loosening up the reins creatively a little bit?
That I'm so tentative to commit to what I think about that, because I mean, on one hand, it is the first time we've actually seen him be like that on a more public scale. And they showed it to us in a smaller way when he, you know, tosses the legal pad to Ace about doing the promo video. So we've seen small little baby steps. So I want to think that because he seemed to follow through and let Ace have a lot of, you know, contribution to the promo, that means he is being sincere about letting these other people in. But I think it's one of those things that it's all so fragile that like he'll let everyone contribute so long as it's what he thinks should happen. Does that make sense? Like he's not going to accept a storyline because even if the whole rest of the group thinks it's good, if he doesn't want to do it. So then does everyone really have a vote or is it still really a dictatorship?
Right, exactly. I'm going to listen to all of you, but ultimately I'm going to make the final call.
Yeah.
I don't know. You probably could have left that out. Yeah. I mean, you probably would have earned some more points with just leaving that last part out. Everyone knows that's true. Yeah. You just saying it just makes you sound like kind of like a douchebag. But he also then says that's time to give up his belt, which I think was maybe even a larger concession on his part. That this realization that narratively, and I think that's Jack's been consistent about that. Narratively, I think Jack realized it's time at the biggest stage the DWL has ever been on. That's when you have a major belt change, and he finally
right? I mean, because what other card do you have to play?
Well, right, but that's Jack being consistent within his own storyline that the belt will change when the story demands it, and acknowledging it. So maybe it's not growth, and it's just Jack sticking to Jack's plan all along. But him saying it out loud does sound philanthropic. You know, like, yeah, it's time for me to give up the belt. Well, Jack, you are always going to give up the belt when the story demanded it.
Right. Well, you had to do something. I mean, what else were you going to do? Like chop a head off or something? This is the state fair. It's the biggest form you've had so far. So it's almost like, well, I don't have any other storylines anyway, so I'm going to give up my belt. Like,
It would have been hysterical if he had said something like, I was going to give it the rooster, but.
That would be awesome.
He's finally got he just like, left.
I wrote an entire script for Rooster.
I was going to surprise him, and then I got his Dear John letter. I got his Dear Jack letter. But again, and another aspect about Jack, and this is why I like this show so much, because I could spend 20 minutes dunking on him, and now I'm going to spend 10, 15 minutes also kind of defending him and having some empathy for him. One, that is a really difficult opening flashback to realize what, as a grown man, you know, within a year or two of the present day, coming back, driving his dad back and forth to Atlanta because of his father's heart problem, which... Did we know Tom Spade had a heart condition?
We did not. I wanted to put like a real big like Sharpie underline under that because, you know, we're looking for a reason for why he killed himself. He's going to end up having some sort of heart issue.
Or has a heart issue. I mean, I got the impression this was a checkup, right?
Yes, yes. But I mean, that is going to end up being, you know, terminal and or just have this sort of like guillotine over his neck kind of feeling of like, well, he's going to go out on his own terms, which is different than he gave up. You know, going out on your own terms is completely different feeling.
I know you don't watch a lot of modern wrestling, but the guillotine is a current popular submission move. So well done with the place.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a modern day sleeper hold that's being used by a popular wrestler. So
I was just doing it earlier today.
Yes. Well, that's how you get your children down for naps. I understand. Yeah, no, I feel like that again, little line, the show just throws out a little line that makes it feel like, well, man, was he on a clock? Maybe that mm-hmm. transforms the whole why.
How could it not be that though, Mike? I mean, what other reason is to even bring up a medical issue unless there's a ticking time?
Right. I think I'm more complimenting the show drops these lines very intentionally, but they don't put a spotlight on it. It's just in the course of overall dialogue that you have to be paying attention to kind of like every line. And so when you look back on it, be like, oh, you know what? They mentioned that. They mentioned the fact that he had maybe had a heart issue. Like, I suspect we're not going to find out about that again, just at the pace of how this information is coming out. One day we may find out that, in fact, he had some kind of terminal issue, and we can look back at the beginning of episode 7 and be like, oh, yeah, they mentioned that. They laid that in there. One more Jack thing is I feel like we've all been there when the world is just closing in on all sides and you just need to scream in your car. When he gets the voicemail from Constance at the fair, the Constance the fair lady about the insurance, and then Tim Leckie at the store picking up more shifts because his boy's got surgery coming, and he got Wild Bill saying he's got a whole script, and but it also involves him having to get a new valet. Sometimes you just got to scream in with all the windows up. Am I wrong? Am I alone in that feeling that sometimes you just have to have a good yell in your car?
I choose the shower normally. Mine's more of a sobbing situation. They did a good job of building the tension in that scene, of feeling, I mean, I felt annoyed by these people's voices. I felt like, for God's sake, like, let a voicemail finish before you even go to the next one because you're like overwhelming me. It's clear to us that Jack is at a breaking point, and what happens next is a big question mark for me. I don't know what he's doing. He seems like he's letting go of the reins a little bit, and he's trying to include other people, maybe because he understands that he needs help, but maybe not. I'm not even really sure of his motivation.
Maybe he doesn't want to wind up with a bad heart like his father.
Maybe. I don't even know. I really don't know.
I've screamed in my car before. There is something very cathartic when it's all just coming in on you and just having a primal scream. I've never cried in the shower. I have many times screamed in my car. So I really empathized with this scene and that feeling of the doom, the drums just closing in on all sides.
I've 100% sat in the driveway and not gone in because I just know there's just like so much work ahead of me that's just sitting there. And I'm like, man, so even that part, you know, of just that pause in the driveway, and then I maybe not scream, but I've done a couple things. I've put my seat back, put my feet up on the dashboard and gone to sleep. And I've definitely put my head down on the steering wheel. I've definitely done those things. Without a doubt.
I think as we close up here on episode 7, I think we need to circle back to the other real ticking time bomb besides Ace is good old Willie Day. I don't know about you, but I think it was a masterful stroke not to have us hear her conversation with Crystal on Crystal's front porch. But it's a silent scene of two women just kind of acting and emoting really well. It ends with the handshake. And then it kind of, you know, Willie goes back to her truck and she lights up the cigarette and Crystal just kind of stares off into space. What did you think of that scene? Did it hit you right away that it, because it ends with a handshake and there's kind of an unreadable face maybe on Crystal until later, until she's in her apartment and she's throwing stuff around in her apartment, in her house. What did you think of that scene? Did that effectively work for you emotionally?
I think that it did a good job of expressing the confusion, like this isn't going the way that it should and the way that it normally does, if that makes sense. So normally we see every scene play out, we hear all the dialogue and we understand what's going on. But in this case, I think that as a viewer being blocked out of the conversation and just having to try to analyze the emotions after the fact, you know, the Willie smoking, her throwing stuff, like, I think that helped actually make the viewer feel as confused and frustrated as these two women did.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And then we get the slow reveal of what actually happened, you know, and it all kind of comes to an understanding.
For people who don't put it together for them.
Well, Willie comes to tell Crystal that she's not making the tryouts. Following her Willie's conversation with Jack, where Jack basically puts the kibosh on, we're going with the dad and no one else, including Crystal, is making it on through from those auditions. Willie takes the step, and I imagine she's not going to everyone's house. I think she's doing a special trip here because she went to the mattress for Crystal to get her hired. She goes and she has a silent scene, a dialogue where the takeaway is essentially she tells her she's not getting hired on as a wrestler in the DWL. That becomes clear later because Crystal is seething in her Barker lounger and she like throws, I think, a ball across the room kind of angrily just as Ace calls to tell her that he's signing with the Florida Wrestling Dystopia. Are you impressed with Crystal? I mean, before we get back to Willie, are you impressed with Crystal that her reaction is not, hell yeah, I'll drive down to Jacksonville now. It's, I gotta go tell Jack before Ace hurts himself. Can we like Crystal anymore? Is it possible?
I was going to say, I mean, I wasn't surprised. I mean, she really cares about them. And I think she cares about the entire Speed family in her own distant way. You know, she's at arm's length from everybody. But I think that she does care and wants to make this work. One of the things I do want to point out when you were saying about like laying on the Barker lounger, that was another one of those scenes that solidified for me. And I hope we get more in season two, that this is not her house. She looked so little and out of place in that living room.
She always kind of looks like a kid waiting for her parents to come home.
Yeah, but in that particular scene, like throwing the ball against the wall kind of thing. I mean, didn't that like totally have that after school vibe of like nobody's home yet?
Latchkey kid, but, like, yeah.
Yeah, didn't it? And in that, and I know we've spoken to this, and it's a small part of the story overall. But I'm so curious as to where the rest of her family is. Like, where's her support net?
I don't know how small a part it is. Actually, I actually think whatever is happening in that personal life, in that empty house that we've seen now inside of a few times in different rooms, and there's never been another soul. And that is, it is not a big house, but it is a big house for a young woman to have by herself, where all the furniture doesn't fit what a young woman's style would probably be like, including the Barker lounger. I think it goes a long way as to maybe explaining why she has taken the Spades as kind of an adopted family. Despite Ace and Jack treating her like shit over and over and over again, even when she goes to Jack's house to tell her and he comes out and he's like, you know, tenacity loses its charm after a while. And she tells him about Ace being in Florida. Jack's reaction isn't thank you. Jack's reaction to Crystal is, what's your angle? Jack, like, why are you such a douchebag to her?
I don't understand the amount of anger towards her.
Can I posit a theory about that I've been mulling on? I've been chewing like cud while we've been talking.
Okay.
What if he's using her as a focus of unexplained anger because she gave him the external green light to turn Ace heel, which he wanted to do, but she verbalized. And maybe he regrets doing that because of all of the consequences that have sprung from it, including the tissues, knowing now how Stacy feels about the tissues, all of the unhinged behavior that Ace has done, including, you know, snapping Bobby's leg. There's a part of me, if he's not that thinks maybe he is projecting onto Crystal and doing some transference and using her as a boogeyman for his own guilt about turning Ace heel. And that's why it's so disproportionate to anything she's ever done to him, which is nothing.
I like it. I mean, I think that you've got to have a why here. You've got to have something more. He doesn't treat Stacy this way. I know we're not saying that he's respectful and great towards Stacy, but he certainly isn't like this. Like, the amount of anger he has towards Crystal is so...
It's the kind of hate you would have for yourself. It's the kind of self-loathing you would have for a mistake that you really regretted but couldn't confess to or admit to anyone.
Yeah, I mean, I'll go for it because we've been given nothing else to really go on. So I like it.
Let's finish up with Willie here. Willie has the scene with Crystal. She had the long day with Jack in that conversation and like talking to a stone wall. She has the scene with Crystal. She goes home and she is just ready to spit fire and take everyone's head off in the day house. Ted's head, Robin's head about not cleaning up the counter. And there's that whole kind of funny but also awkward and sad interaction about how she forgot and set a reminder Robin did about cleaning up. And
yeah, I thought Willie was being really hard on the kid.
Really off base. Really just...
I thought so.
She came in looking to bite the heads of her family. And you get the impression it's not the first time. This seems like just a sometimes in the Willie day way of being, you know, in her family. But it's this conversation with Ted outside where he is determined to patiently and lovingly talk with her. And she wants no part of it. And she's pleading with him to not push her because she doesn't want to say things that she's going to regret. And he says to her, because they're the truth. And then we get this whole exchange here. And I think it's important to listen to.
This situation at the DWL, Tom, Bill, Jack, has put you in some kind of a undefinable, I don't know, distress. And it's startling. I mean, you're drinking way more than you have been.
Deal with it.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do. Just because the Spade family has staked their entire identity on this league doesn't mean that we have to. You're a talented producer, administrator. You could work at a theater, college.
In Duffy.
Yeah, well, we can move.
Look, I don't want to talk about this. I don't want to talk, and I don't want to listen to you talk.
Well, you just prefer to sit and drink?
Yes.
Willie.
Ted, I don't want to say things I shouldn't.
Because they're the truth? Willie, you had a life before me. I had a life before you. I understand that Bill's return has brought some emotions up to the surface.
I don't want to talk about it. I told you. I told you I didn't want to talk about it, and you had to go on talking. I told you. Fucking told you. Fuck.
All right, first off, when Mary McCormick submits her Emmy... supporting actress nomination, clearly that's the scene she's going to support, because even just listening to it, just the audio of it, it's a pretty powerful scene. But what's happening here? Why is she having this emotional? Is it just the stress of the day, Caroline? Or is it there is something with Bill here? There's some unrequited whatever that Ted is trying to very rationally and maturely talk about, and she is just not having it.
I think there's unresolved trauma for sure, without a doubt. I mean, everything that's going on, you know, there was some amount of betrayal. We don't know what is connected to the actual killing of himself part. So, you know, there's all these like, you know, mixing portions here. Like anything could be what she's super upset about. I give Ted a lot of credit. I mean, for me, that's my role. That's the exact person I am. I'm like the person who's like, I understand you don't want to talk, but...
Y'all, I have argued and I have railed in Caroline's presence, and she is Ted. She is a calm, cool voice of rational, calming behavior.
I appreciate the sentiment of like, I don't want to talk about this. And like my response is like, there's a lot of things we don't want to do, but we need to do it. And like, I get it. I was surprised that the conversation totally ended at her being like, I said I didn't want to talk about it and I don't want to talk. Totally understood. Like, heard. However, like, he already laid out, like, you have been doing this destructive behavior, and this is, and now you're screaming at our teenage daughter. You know, this is a moment where I'm saying, like, hey, we got to pump the brakes, and we at least have to do some amount of introspection here, you know, and he's been playing his part this entire time. He laid it all out about Bill. I understand. And I'm not the person who necessarily needs to say, I'm just going to go sit and drink and I don't want to talk. I have times when I need to, like, collect myself because I can't necessarily formulate my emotions and my words all in the way that I'd like to. But the whole concept that the best way to handle something is just not to talk about it and just keep pushing that along, I can't do that. Now, I know, because I know you, that you might have a bit of this part inside of you of needing to just, you know, when he goes, what do you just want to sit and drink? The relief in her voice when she was like, yes. I think I've heard that out of you.
Oh, I felt it. I mean, I've literally said that yes before. Like, yes. Yeah. That is what I'd like to do. To me, it felt like when she said, I don't want to say certain things that I shouldn't. And he says, because they're true. I took that initially like, you know, she's going to confess some kind of like love affair with Bill or whatever. And, you know, I felt like that was what Ted was really getting at when he's talking about like we had a life before each other, which is interesting, you know, but we knew, right? Because we knew she spent her crazy 20s with Bill and whoever else, maybe Tom, you know, maybe Jack is, is Willie's kid. Who knows? You know, whatever it is. You know, it definitely seemed like Ted is thinking that there's some kind of love affair or some kind of thing that she is either embarrassed by or traumatized by, that if she says aloud, it will become true to her. And so as long as she doesn't say it aloud, as long as she doesn't speak the words, she can continue to deny its existence or deny its truth. There's something very powerful about saying something out loud. You may know it's true. You may know it may be eating you up inside. But when you actually verbalize it, there are certain things that begin to have even more power and are even more destructive once said out loud, because they become true in a way. It's like Schrodinger's cat. You know, it's not alive. It's not true or untrue as long as it stays inside. But once you speak it aloud, you have now made it true. And I think that's kind of what Ted is trying to get her to do. And she is just resisting with all of her might from doing. What that is exactly, we don't know. But it's something. It's something horrific, I have to imagine, or something very traumatic.
I think that Willie has a lot going on with her. And she definitely, I mean, we've seen just the anger that she puts out on Crystal too. It's all making me feel so much worse for Crystal. Like, she is just the punching bag for so many people. It's so wrong. What do you think about this? We see Stacy decide enough is enough and take the kid and head out. I mean, we're seeing Willie be just as destructive and just as ugly to her family members. I appreciated when he just said, we can move. Like, you don't need to be doing this. Like, we don't need to be doing this here. Like, we can stop all of this. Right. I mean, I was
we're
like,
not
Ted.
Spades, right? We're
yeah,
not
like,
spades.
You are speaking the truth about, like, we are putting so much energy into a thing that is optional, completely optional.
Yeah, but for whatever reason, it's not optional to Willie, and that's part of what I think she's not. She's afraid to speak into truth, into the ether. Is whatever it is that's not making it optional for her. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of similarities here between Ted and Stacy. These people who don't understand why their lives revolve around the DWL, or why their lives revolve around the DWL because the people they love most in the world's lives revolve around the DWL, you know. But Ted is they're a bit older than Stacy, obviously, and so he has, you know, some of the distance to be able to say, fuck, we can move. You could go do anything else. We can go make it work. We don't need to be here. Like, we are not actually chained here. But Willie
thinks they are, or Willie thinks she is. And that's what I think we need to get at. What is in her past or present that we don't know about that makes her feel as chained to the dome as Jack feels?
Affairs were had, in my opinion, and things went down, in my opinion. And I don't know. I don't know what was going on. You know, who knows what Bill paid for?
I tell you one thing, Ted is really rolling with the changes. Yeah! Just joking. I'm not going to play the whole song again.
This is Caroline.
And this is Mike. Thank you for listening to the Duffy Wrestling Dirt Sheet of Heels podcast. Make sure you join us next week for our season finale coverage, Double Turn, featuring our interview with Allison Luff returning to the Dirt Sheet to talk to us, Stacey Spade herself. In the meantime, catch up on all of our episodes at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're there, if you could rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast and all of Pod Clubhouse's podcasts, that would be fantastic so that you don't make my spirit feel broken.
Oh, that's so sad. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.